Chapter 12. Once back at Hetton House, Blaze caused no trouble. He kept his head down and his mouth shut. The boys who had been biggins when he and John had been littleins either made out, went out to work, went away to vocational schools, or joined the army. Blaze grew another 3 inches. Hair sprouted on his chest and grew lushly on his crotch. This made him the envy of the other boys. He went to Freeport High School. It was all right, because they didn't make him do arithmetic. Martin Koslaw's contract was renewed, and he watched Blaze come and go unsmilingly, watchfully. He did not call Blaze into his office again, although Blaze knew he could. And if the law told him to bend over and take the paddle, Blaze knew he would do it. The alternative was North Windham Training Center, which was a formatory. He had heard that in the formatory boys were actually whipped, like on ships, and sometimes put in a little metal box called the tin. Blaze didn't know if these things were true, and had no wish to find out. What he knew was he was afraid of the formatory. But the law never called him in to be paddled, and Blaze never gave him cause. He went to school 5 days a week, and his chief contact with the head became the law's voice, bellowing over the intercoms first thing in the morning and before lights out at night. At Hetton House, the day always began with what Martin Koslaw called a homily. Homily grits, John sometimes said when he was feeling funny, and ended with a Bible verse. Life moved along. He could have become the king of the boys if he had wished, but he did not wish. He wasn't a leader. He was the farthest thing from a leader. He tried to be nice to people, though. He tried to be nice to them even when he was warning them he would crack their skulls open if they didn't lay off his friend Johnny. Pretty soon, after Blaze came back, they did lay off him. Then on a summer night when Blaze was 14 and looking 6 years older in the right light, something happened. The boys were hauled to town on an ancient yellow bus every Friday, assuming that as a group they didn't have too many DDs, discipline demerits. Some would just wander aimlessly up and down Main Street or sit in the town square or go up an alley to smoke cigarettes. There was a pool hall, but it was off limits to them. There was also a second-run movie theater, the Nordica, and those boys who had enough money to buy a ticket could go in and see how Jack Nicholson, Warren Beatty, or Clint Eastwood looked when those gentlemen were younger. Some of the boys earned their money delivering papers. Some mowed lawns in the summer and shoveled snow in the winter. Some had jobs at HH itself. Blaze had become one of those. He was the size of a man, a big one, and the chief custodian hired him to do chores and odd jobs. Martin Koslaw might have objected, but Frank Terrio didn't answer to that priss. He liked Blaze's broad shoulders. A quiet man himself, Terrio also liked Blaze's way of saying yes and no, and not much more. The boy didn't mind heavy work, either. He'd lug packs of bird shingles up a ladder, or 100-pound sacks of cement all afternoon. He'd move classroom furniture and filing cabinets up and down stairs, not saying boo to a goose. And there was no quit in him. Best thing? He seemed perfectly happy with $1.60 an hour, which allowed Terrio to pocket an extra $60 a week. Eventually, he bought his wife a swanky cashmere sweater. It had a boat neck. She was delighted. Blaze was delighted, too. He was making a cool $30 a week, which was more than enough to pay for the movies, plus all the popcorn, candy, and soda he could put away. He bought John's ticket, too, cheerfully as a matter of course. He would have been happy to throw in all the usual snacks as well, but for John, the movie was usually enough. He watched greedily, his mouth agape. Back at Hetton, John was beginning to write stories. They were stumbling things, cribbed from the movies he watched with Blaze, but they began to earn him a certain popularity with his peers. The other boys didn't like you to be smart, but they admired a certain kind of cleverness, and they liked stories. They were hungry for stories. On one of their trips, they saw a vampire movie called Second Coming. John Cheltzman's version of this classic ended with Count Igor Yorga ripping the head from a half-clad young lovely with quaking breasts the size of watermelons and jumping into the river Yorba with the head under his arm. The strangely patriotic name of this underground classic was The Eyes of Yorga Are Upon You. But this night, John didn't want to go, even though another horror movie was playing. He had the runs. He'd been 5 times that morning and afternoon, despite half a bottle of Pepto from the infirmary, a glorified closet on the second floor. He thought he wasn't done, either. "Come on," Blaze urged. "The Nordic has got a terrific crapper downstairs. I took a shit there once myself. We'll stick real close to it." Thus persuaded, despite the dire rumblings in his vitals, John went with Blaze and got on the bus. They sat up front behind the driver. They were almost the big uns now, after all. John was okay during the previews, but just as the Warner Brothers logo was coming on, he stood up, slid past Blaze, and started up the aisle in a crabwise walk. Blaze was sympathetic, but that was life. He turned his attention back to the screen where a dust storm was blowing around in what looked like the desert of Maine, only with pyramids. Soon he was deeply involved in the story, frowning with concentration. When John sat back down beside him, he was hardly aware of him, until John started yanking his sleeve and whispering, "Blaze? Blaze! For God's sakes, Blaze!" Blaze came out of the movie like a sound sleeper waking from a nap. "What's the matter? You sick? You shit yourself?" "No, no. Look at this." Blaze peered at what John was holding just below seat level. It was a wallet. "Hey, where'd you—" "Shh," somebody in front of them hissed. "Get that," Blaze finished in a whisper. "In the men's room," John whispered back. He was trembling with excitement. "It must have fallen out of some guy's pants when he sat down to take a dump. There's money in it. Lots of money." Blaze took the wallet, holding it well out of sight. He opened the bill compartment. He felt his stomach drop. Then it seemed to bounce and cram itself halfway up his throat. The bill compartment was full of dough. $1, $2, $3 $50 bills, $4 $20s, couple of fives, some ones. "I can't count it all up," he whispered. "How much?" John's voice rose in slightly awed triumph, but it went unnoticed. The monster was after a girl in brown shorts, and the audience was happily screaming. $248. "Jesus," Blaze said. "You still got that rip in the lining of your coat?" "Sure." "Put it in there. They may frisk us going out." But no one did, and John's runs were cured. Finding that much money seemed to have scared the shit out of him. John bought a Portland Press Herald from Stevie Ross, who had a paper route, on Monday morning. He and Blaze went out behind the tool shed and opened it to the classified ads. John said that was the place to look. The lost and founds were on page 38, and there, between a lost French poodle and a found pair of women's gloves, was the following item. Lost, a man's black leather wallet with the initials RKF stamped beside the photo compartment. If found, call 555-0928 or write box 595, care of this newspaper. Reward offered. "Reward!" Blaze exclaimed and punched John on the shoulder. "Yeah," John said. He rubbed where Blaze had punched. "So we call the guy and he gives us $10 plus a pat on the head. BFD. This stood for big fucking deal. Oh. The word reward had been standing in letters of gold 2 feet high in Blaze's mind. Now they collapsed to a pile of leaden rubble. Then what should we do with it? It was the first time he had really looked to Johnny for leadership. The $248 was a mystifying problem. If you had 2 bits, you bought a Coke. $2 got you into the movies. Going further now, struggling, Blaze supposed you could ride the bus all the way to Portland and go to the show there. But for a sum this size, his imagination was no good. All he could think of was clothes. Blaze cared nothing for clothes. "Let's run away," John said. His narrow face was bright with excitement. Blaze considered. You mean, like, forever? Nah, just till the wad's gone. We'll go to Boston, eat in big restaurants instead of Mickey D's, get a hotel room, see the Red Sox play, and... But he could go no further. Joy overcame him. He leaped on Blaze, laughing and pounding his back. His body was lean under his clothes, light and hard. His face burned against Blaze's cheek like the side of a furnace. Okay, Blaze said. That'd be fun. He thought about it. Jesus, Johnny. Boston? Boston. Ain't it a royal pisser? They began to laugh. Blaze carried John all the way around the tool shed, both of them laughing and pounding each other on the back. John finally made him stop. Someone'll hear, Blaze, or see. Put me down. Blaze recaptured the newspaper, which had begun to flutter all over the yard. He folded it up and rammed it down in his hip pocket. We going now, Johnny? Not for a while. Maybe not for 3 days. We gotta make a plan, and we gotta be careful. If we aren't, they'll catch us before we get 20 miles. Bring us back. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah, but I'm not very good at making plans, Johnny. That's okay, I got most of it figured out already. The important thing is that they'll think we just buzzed off, because that's what kids do when they make out from this shit farm, right? Right. Only we got money, right? Right! Blaze was overcome with the deliciousness of it again, and pounded Johnny on the back until he almost knocked him over. They waited until the following Wednesday night. In the meantime, John called the Greyhound terminal in Portland and found out there was a bus for Boston every morning at 7 a.m. They left Hetton House at a little past midnight, John figuring it would be safest to walk the 15 miles into the city rather than attract attention by hitchhiking. Two kids on the road after midnight were runaways, period. They went down the fire escape, hearts thumping at each rusty rattle, and jumped from the lowest platform. They ran across the playground, where Blaze had taken his first beatings as a newcomer many years before. Blaze helped John climb over the chain-link fence on the far side. They crossed the road under a hot August moon and started to walk, diving into the ditch whenever an infrequent car showed headlights on the horizon, ahead or behind them. They were on Congress Street by 6 o'clock, Blaze still fresh and excited. John with circles under his eyes. Blaze was carrying the wad in his jeans, the wallet they had thrown into the woods. When they reached the bus depot, John collapsed onto a bench, and Blaze sat down beside him. John's cheeks were flushed again, but not with excitement. He seemed to be having trouble with his breath. Go over and get 2 round trippers on the 7 o'clock, he told Blaze. Give her a 50. I don't think it'll be more, but have a 20 ready just in case. Have it in your hand. Don't let her see the roll. A policeman walked over, tapping his nightstick. Blaze felt his bowels turn to water. This was where it ended, before it had even gotten started. Their money would be taken away. The cop might turn it in, or he might keep it for himself. As for them, they would be driven back to HH, maybe in handcuffs. Black visions of North Wyndham Training Center rose before his eyes. And the tin.
Morning, boys. Here kinda early, ain't ya?
The clock on the depot wall read 6:22.
Sure are, John said. He nodded toward the ticket cage. Is that where a fella goes to get his ticket?
You bet, the cop said, smiling a little. Where you headed?
Boston, John said.
Oh? Where's you boys' folks?
Oh, him and me aren't related, John said. This fella's retarded. His name's Martin Griffin, deaf and dumb, too.
Is that so?
The cop sat down and studied Blaze. He didn't look suspicious. He just looked like someone who had never seen a person before who scored the trifecta. Deaf, dumb, and retarded.
His mama died last week, John said. He stays with us. My folks work, but since it's summer vacation, they said to me, would you take him? And I said I would.
Big job for a kid, the cop said.
I'm a little scared, John said. and Blaze Betty was telling the truth there. He was scared, too, scared plenty. The cop nodded to Blaze and said,
"Does he understand?"
"What happened to her? Not too good." The cop looked sad. "I'm taking him to his auntie's house. That's where he's going to stay for a few days." John brightened. "Me? I might get to go to a Red Sox game. It's sort of a reward for, you know."
"Well, I hope you do, son. It's an ill wind that don't blow somebody a little good."
They were both silent, considering this. Blaze, newly mute, was silent too. Then the cop said,
"He's a big one. Think you can handle him?"
"He's big, but he minds. Want to see?"
"Well,
here. I'll make him stand. Watch." John made a number of meaningless finger gestures in front of Blaze's eyes. When he stopped, Blaze stood up.
"Say, that's pretty good," the cop said. "He always minds you? Because a big boy like this on a bus full of people..."
"Nah, he always minds. No more homonym than a paper sack."
"Okay, I take your word for it."
The cop got to his feet. He hitched up his gun belt and pushed on Blaze's shoulders. Blaze sat back down again on the bench.
"You take care, young fella. You know his auntie's phone number if you get in trouble?"
"Yes, sir, I sure do," John said.
"Okay, keep 'em flying, Sarge."
He flipped John a little salute and went strolling out of the bus station. When he was gone, they looked at each other and almost broke into giggles. But the ticket agent was now watching, and they looked down at the floor instead, Blaze biting the insides of his lips. "You got a bathroom in here?" John called to the ticket agent. "Over there," she pointed. "Come on, Marty," John said, and Blaze just about had to howl at that. When they got into the John, they finally collapsed into each other's arms. "That was really good," Blaze said when he could talk again without laughing. "Where'd you get that name?" "When I saw him, all I could think of was how the law was going to get us again. And Griffin, that's the name of a mythical bird. You know, I helped you with that story in your English book?"
"Yeah,"
Blaze said delightedly, not remembering the griffin at all.
"Yeah, sure, right. But they'll know it was us when they find out we're gone from Hell House," John said. He had turned serious. "That cop'll remember for sure. He'll be mad, too. Christ, won't he?"
"We're gonna get caught, aren't we?"
"Nah."
John still looked tired, but the exchange with the cop had put the sparkle back in his eyes.
"Once we get to Boston, we'll drop right out of sight. They aren't gonna look too hard for a couple of kids."
"Oh, good. But I better buy the tickets. You keep on being a mutie until we get to Boston. It's safer that way."
"Sure."
So Johnny bought the tickets, and they got on the bus, which seemed mostly filled with guys in uniform and young women traveling with little kids. The driver had a pot belly and a satchel ass, but his gray uniform had creases in the pants, and Blaze thought it was really sharp. He thought he would like to be a Greyhound bus driver when he grew up. The doors hissed shut. The heavy engine rumbled up to a roar. The bus backed out of its dock and turned onto Congress Street. They were moving. They were going somewhere. Blaze couldn't fill his eyes up enough. They went over a bridge and got on Route 1. Then they began to roll faster. They went past oil tanks and billboards advertising motels, and Prouty's, Maine's best lobster restaurant. They went past houses, and Blaze saw a man watering his lawn. The man was wearing Bermuda shorts and wasn't going nowhere. Blaze felt sorry for him. They went past tidal flats with seagulls flying over them. What John called Hell House was behind them. It was summer, and the day was brightening. Finally, he turned to John. If he didn't tell someone how good he felt, he thought he would split wide open. But John had fallen asleep with his head on one shoulder. In his sleep, he looked old and tired. Blaze considered this for a moment, uneasily, then turned back to the scenic cruiser window. It pulled him like a magnet. He sightsaw and forgot about John for a while
as he watched the tawdry seacoast strip between Portland and Kittery slide by. In New Hampshire, they got on the turnpike, and then they were in Massachusetts. Not long after that, they were crossing a big bridge, and then he guessed they were in Boston. There were miles of neon, thousands of cars and buses and buildings in every direction. Yet still the bus kept going. They passed an orange dinosaur guarding a car lot. They passed a huge sailing ship. They passed a herd of plastic cows in front of some restaurant. He saw people everywhere. They frightened him. He also loved them, because they were strange to him. John slept on, snoring a little in the back of his throat. Then they breasted a hill, and there was an even bigger bridge with even bigger buildings beyond it, skyscrapers shooting into the blue like silver and gold arrows. Blaze tore his eyes away, as if it had been an atomic bomb blast. "Johnny," he said, almost moaning it. "Johnny, wake up. You gotta see this." "Huh? What?" John woke slowly, knuckling his eyes. Then he saw what Blaze had been seeing through the big scenic cruiser window, and his eyes popped wide. "Mother of God! Do you know where we should go?" Blaze whispered. "Yeah, I think so. My God, are we going over that bridge? We gotta, don't we?" It was the Mystic, and they went over it. It first took them up to the sky, and then below the ground, like a giant version of the wild mouse at Topsom Fair. And when they finally came out into the sun again, it was shining between buildings so tall you couldn't see the tops of them through the big dog's windows. When Blaze and Johnny finally got off at the Tremont Street terminal, the first thing they did was look for cops. They need not have bothered. The terminal was huge. Announcements blared from overhead like the voice of God. Travelers schooled like fish. Blaze and Johnny huddled close together, shoulder to shoulder, as if afraid opposing currents of travelers might sweep them apart, never to see each other again. "Over there," Johnny said. "Come on." They walked over to a bank of phones. They were all in use. They waited by the one on the end until the black man using it finished his call and walked away. "What was that thing around his head?" Blaze asked, staring after the black man with fascination. "Oh, that's to keep his hair straight, like a turban. I think they call them do-rags. Don't stare, you look like a hick. Squeeze up next to me." Blaze did. "Now give me a di-" "Holy shit! This thing takes a quarter." John shook his head. "I don't know how people live here. Give me a quarter, Blaze." Blaze did. There was a phone book bound in stiff plastic covers on the shelf of the kiosk. John consulted it, dropped his quarter, and dialed. When he spoke, he deepened his voice. When he hung up, he was smiling. "We got two nights at the Huntington Avenue YMCA. $20 for two nights. Call me a Christian." He raised his hand. Blaze slapped it, then said, "But we can't spend almost $200 in 2 days, can we? In a town where a phone call costs a quarter? You shitting me?" John looked around with glowing eyes. It was as though he owned the bus terminal and everything in it. Blaze would not see anyone with that exact same look in his eyes for a long time. Not until he met George. "Listen, Blaze, let's go to the ball game now. What do you say?" Blaze scratched his head. It was all going too fast for him. "How? We don't even know how to get there." "Every cab in Boston knows how to get to Fenway." "Cabs cost money. We ain't—" He saw Johnny smiling, and he began to smile, too. Sweet truth dawned in a burst. They did. They did have money. And this was what money was for, to cut through the bullshit. "But what if there's no day game?" "Blaze, why do you think I picked today to go?" Blaze began to laugh. Then they were in each other's arms again, just like in Portland. They pounded each other on the back and laughed into each other's faces.
Blaze never forgot it. He picked John up and twirled him around twice in the air. People turned to look, most of them smiling at the big galoot and his skinny pal. They went out and got their cab, and when the hacky dropped them on Lansdowne Street, John tipped him a buck. It was 12:45, and the scant daytime crowd was just starting to trickle in. The game was a thriller. Boston beat the Birds in 10, 3-2. Boston fielded a bad team that year, but on that August afternoon they played like champs. After the game, the boys wandered the downtown area, rubbernecking and trying to avoid cops. The shadows were growing long by then, and Blaze's belly was rumbling. John had gobbled a couple of dogs at the game, but Blaze had been too enthralled by the spectacle of the ball players on the field, real people with sweat on their necks, to eat. He had also been awed by the size of the crowd, thousands of people all in the same place. But now he was hungry. They went into a dim, narrow place called Lindy's Steakhouse that smelled of beer and charring beef. A number of couples sat in high booths padded with red leather. To the left was a long bar, scratched and pitted but still glowing like there was light in the wood. There were bowls of salted nuts and pretzels spotted along it every 3 feet or so. Behind the bar were photos of ballplayers, some signed, and a painting of a bare-naked woman. The man presiding over the bar was very large. He bent toward them.
"What's yours, boys?"
"Ah," John said. For the first time that day, he appeared stymied.
"Steak," Blaze said. "Two big steaks, and milk to go with."
The big man grinned, showing formidable teeth. He looked like he could have chewed a phone book to ribbons.
"Got money?"
Blaze slapped a 20 on the counter. The big man picked it up and checked Andy Jackson by the light. He snapped the bill between his fingers, then he made it disappear.
"Okay," he said.
"No change?"
John asked.
The big man said, "No, and you won't be sorry."
He turned, opened a freezer, and took out two of the biggest, reddest steaks Blaze had ever seen in his life. There was a deep grill at the end of the bar, and when the big man tossed the steaks on almost contemptuously, flames leaped up.
"Hick special, coming right up," he said.
He drew a few beers, put out new dishes of nuts, then made salads and put them on ice. When the salads were taken care of, he flipped the steaks and walked back to John and Blaze. He placed his dishwater-reddened mitts on the bar and said,
"You fellas see that gent at the far end of the bar, sitting all by his lonesome?"
Blaze and John looked. The gent at the end of the bar was dressed in a natty blue suit and was morosely sipping a beer.
"That's Daniel J. Monahan, Detective Daniel J. Monahan of Boston's finest. I don't suppose you'd like to talk to him about how a couple of hicks such as your fine selves have 20 to put down on prime beef."
John Cheltzman looked suddenly sick. He reeled a little on his stool. Blaze put a hand out to steady him. Mentally, he set his feet.
"We got that money fair and square," he said. "That right? Who'd you stick up fair and square? Or was it a fair and square muggin'?"
"We got that money fair and square. We found it. And if you spoil it for Johnny and me, I'll bust you one." The man behind the bar looked at Blaze with a mixture of surprise, admiration, and contempt.
"You're big, but you're a fool, boy. Close either fist and I'll put you on the moon. If you spoil our holiday, I'll bust you one, mister. Where are you from? New Hampshire Correctional? North Windham? Not from Boston, that's for sure. You boys got hay in your hair."
"We're from Hetton House," Blaze said. "We ain't crooks." The Boston detective at the end of the bar had finished his beer. He gestured with the empty glass for another. The big man saw it and cracked a smile.
"Sit tight, the both of you. No need to put on your skates."
The big man brought Monahan another beer, and said something that made Monahan laugh. It was a hard sound, not much humor in it.
The bartender cook came back. "Where's this Hetton House place?" Now it was John he was speaking to.
"In Cumberland, Maine," John said. "They let us go to the movies in Freeport on Friday night. I found a wallet in the men's bathroom. There was money inside. So we ran away to have a holiday, just like Blaze said."
"Just happened to find a wallet, huh?"
"Yes, sir."
"And how much was in this fabled wallet?"
"About $250.
"Bald-headed Jesus. And I bet you got it all in your pockets, too."
"Where else?"
John looked mystified.
"Bald-headed Jesus," the big man said again.
He looked up at the scalloped tin ceiling. He rolled his eyes. "And you tell a stranger, just as easy as kiss your hand." The big man leaned forward with his fingers splayed on the bar. His face had been cruelly handled by the years, but it wasn't cruel.
"I believe you," he said. "You got too much hay in your hair to be liars. But that cop down there, boys, I could sic him on you like a dog on a rat. You'd be cellbound while him and me was splitting that money."
"I'd bust you one," Blaze said. "That's our money. Me and Johnny found it. Look, we've been in that place, and it's a bad place to be in. A guy like you, maybe you think you know stuff, but... Aw, never mind. We earned it."
"You're gonna be a bruiser when you get your full growth," the big man said, almost to himself. Then he looked at John. "Your friend here, he's a few tools short of a full box. You know that, right?"
John had recovered himself. He didn't say anything, only returned the big man's gaze steadily.
"You take care of him," the big man said, and he smiled suddenly. "Bring him back here when he gets his full growth. I want to see what he looks like then."
John didn't smile back, looked more solemn than ever, in fact. But Blaze did. He understood it was all right. The big man produced the $20 bill. It seemed to come from nowhere, and shoved it at John.
"These stakes are on the house, boys. You take that and go to the baseball tomorrow, if you ain't had your pockets picked by then."
"We went today," John said. "Was it good?" the big man asked, and now John did smile. "It was the greatest thing I ever saw."
"Yeah," the big man said. "Sure it was. Watch out for your buddy."
"I will."
"Because buddies stick together."
"I know it."
The big man brought the steaks and Caesar salads and new peas and huge mounds of string fries and huge glasses of milk. For dessert, he brought them wedges of cherry pie with scoops of vanilla ice cream melting on top. At first they ate slowly. Then Detective Monahan of Boston's Finest left, without paying nothing so far as Blaze could see, and they both pitched two. Blaze had two pieces of pie and three glasses of milk, and then the third time the big guy refilled Blaze's glass, he laughed out loud. When they left, the neon signs in the street were coming on.
"You go to the Y," the big man said before they did.
"Do it right away. City's no place for a couple of kids to be wandering around at night."
"Yes, sir," John said.
"I already called and fixed it."
The big man smiled.
"You're all right, kid. You're pretty good. Keep the bear close, and walk behind him if anyone comes up and tries to brace you. Especially kids wearing colors. You know, gang jackets."
"Yes, sir."
"Take care of each other."
That was his final word on it. The next day they rode the subways until the novelty wore off, and then they went to the movies, and then they went to the ballgame again. It was late when they got out, almost 11, and someone picked Blaze's pocket. But Blaze had put his share of the money in his underwear the way Johnny told him to, and the pickpocket got a big handful of nothing. Blaze never saw what he looked like, just a narrow back weaving its way into the crowd exiting through Gate A. They stayed two more days and saw more movies and one play that Blaze didn't understand, although Johnny liked it. They sat in something called The Lodge that was five times as high as the balcony at the Nordica. They went into a department store photo booth and had their pictures made, some of Blaze, some of Johnny, some of them both together. In the ones together they were laughing.
They rode the subway some more until Johnny got train sick and threw up on his sneakers. Then a Negro man came over and shouted at them about the end of the world. He seemed to be saying it was their fault, but Blaze couldn't tell for sure. Johnny said the guy was crazy. Johnny said there were a lot of crazy people in the city.
"They breed here like fleas," Johnny said.
They still had some money left, and it was Johnny who suggested the final touch. They took a Greyhound back to Portland, then spent the rest of their dividend on a taxi. John fanned the remaining bills in front of the startled driver, almost $50 worth of crumpled fives and ones, some smelling fragrantly of Clayton Blaisdell Jr.'s underpants, and told him they wanted to go to Hetton House in Cumberland. The cabbie dropped his flag, and at 2:05 on a sunny, late summer afternoon, they pulled up at the gate. John Chelsman took 6 steps up the drive toward the brooding brick pile and fainted dead away. He had rheumatic fever. He was dead 2 years later.
Chapter 13.
By the time Blaze got the baby into the shack, Joe was screaming his head off. Blaze stared at him in wonder. He was furious. The face was flushed across the forehead and the cheeks, even the bridge of the tiny nose. His eyes were squinched shut. His fists made tiny circles of rage in the air. Blaze felt sudden panic. What if the kid was sick? What if he had the flu or something? Kids caught the flu every day. Sometimes they died of it, and he couldn't very well take him to a doctor's office. What did he know about kids anyway? He was just a dummy. He could barely take care of himself. He had a sudden wild urge to take the baby back out to the car, to drive him to Portland and leave him on somebody's doorstep.
"George," he cried. "George, what should I do?"
He was afraid George had gone away again, but George answered up from the bathroom.
"Feed him. Give him something out of one of those jars."
Blaze ran into the bedroom. He clawed one of the cartons out from under the bed, opened it, and selected a jar at random. He took it back to the kitchen and found a spoon. He put the jar on the table beside the wicker basket and opened the lid. What was inside looked awful, like puke. Maybe it was spoiled. He smelled it anxiously. It smelled all right. It smelled like peas. That was all right, then. He hesitated just the same. The idea of actually putting food in that open, screaming mouth seemed somehow irreversible. What if the little motherfucker choked on it? What if he just didn't want it? What if it was somehow the wrong stuff for him and... His mind tried to put up the word poison, and Blaze wouldn't look at it. He stuffed 1/2 spoonful of cold peas in the baby's mouth. The cries stopped at once. The baby's eyes popped open, and Blaze saw they were blue. Joe spit some of the peas back, and Blaze tucked the goop back in with the end of the spoon, not thinking about it, just doing it. The baby sucked contentedly. Blaze fed him another spoonful. It was accepted, and another. In 7 minutes, the entire jar of Gerber peas was gone. Blaze had a crick in his back from bending over the wicker basket. Joe belched a runnel of green foam. Blaze mopped it off the small cheek with the tail of his own shirt. "Bring it up again, and we'll vote on it," he said. This was one of George's witticisms. Joe blinked at the sound of his voice. Blaze stared back, fascinated. The baby's skin was clear and unblemished. His head was capped with a surprising thatch of blonde hair, but his eyes were what got Blaze. He thought they were old eyes somehow, wise eyes. They were the washed-out blue of desert skies in a Western movie. The corners turned up a little, like the eyes of Chinese people. They gave him a fierce look, almost a warrior look. "You a fighter?" Blaze asked. "You a fighter, little man?" One of Joe's thumbs crept into his mouth, and he began to suck it. At first, Blaze thought he might want a bottle, and he hadn't figured out the Playtex nurser gadget yet.
but for the time being the kid seemed content with his thumb. His cheeks were still flushed, not with crying now, but from his trip through the night. His lids began to droop, and the corners of his eyes lost that fierce upward tilt. But still he peered at this man, this 6'7" stubbled giant with the crazed and scarecrowed brown hair who stood over him. Then the eyes closed, his thumb dropped out of his mouth, he slept. Blaze straightened up and his back popped. He turned away from the basket and started for the bedroom.
"Hey, Dinkleballs," George said from the bathroom. "Where do you think you're going?"
"To bed."
"The hell you are. You're gonna figure out that bottle gadget and fix the kid 4 to 5, for when he wakes up."
"The milk might go sour."
"Not if you put it in the fridge. You warm it up when you need it."
"Oh." Blaze got the Playtex nurser kit and read the instructions. He read them twice. It took him half an hour. He didn't understand hardly anything the first time, and even less the second.
"I can't, George," he said at last.
"Sure you can. Throw those instructions away and just roll."
So Blaze threw the instructions into the stove, and then just fooled with the gadget, the way you did with a carb that wasn't set quite right. Eventually, he figured out that you fitted the plastic liner over the gadget's nozzle and then plunged it into the bottle shell. Bingo. Pretty slick. He prepared 4 bottles, filled them with canned milk, and put them away in the fridge.
"Can I go to bed now, George?" he asked.
No answer. Blaze went to bed. Joe woke him in the first gray light of morning. Blaze stumbled out of bed and went into the kitchen. He had left the baby in the basket, and now the basket was rocking back and forth on the table with the force of Joe's anger. Blaze picked him up and laid him against his shoulder. He saw part of the problem right away. The kid was soaked through. Blaze took him into the bedroom and laid him on his bed. He looked amazingly small, lying there in the indentation of Blaze's body. He was wearing blue PJs, and he kicked his feet indignantly. Blaze took off his pajamas and the rubber pants beneath. He put a hand on Joe's belly to hold him still. Then he bent close to observe the way the diapers were pinned together. He took them off and threw them in the corner. He observed Joe's penis and felt instant delight. Not much longer than his thumbnail, but standing straight up, pretty cute.
"That's quite a rod you got there, Skinner," he said.
Joe left off crying to stare up at Blaze with wide, surprised eyes.
"I said that's quite a rod you got on you."
Joe smiled.
"Goo goo," Blaze said.
He felt an unwilling idiot grin tug the corners of his mouth. Joe gurgled.
"Goo goo, baby," Blaze said.
Joe laughed aloud.
"Goo goo, baby," Blaze said delighted.
Joe pissed in his face. The Pampers were another struggle. At least they didn't have pins, just tapes. And they seemed to have their own built-in rubber pants, plastic actually. But he wrecked 2 before he finally got one on like the picture on the box. When the job was done, Joe was wide awake and chewing on the ends of his fingers. Blaze supposed he wanted something to eat and thought a bottle might be best. He was heating it under the hot water faucet in the kitchen, turning it around and around, when George said,
"Did you dilute it the way the broad in the store said to?"
Blaze looked at the bottle.
"Huh?"
"That's straight canned milk, isn't it?"
"Sure, right out of the can. Is it spoiled, George?"
"No, it isn't spoiled. But if you don't take off the cap and put in some water, he'll puke."
"Oh."
Blaze used his fingernails to pull the top off the Playtex nurser and poured about 1/4 of the bottle down the sink. He added enough water to fill it back up, stirred it with a spoon, and put the nipple back on.
"Blaze."
George didn't sound mad, but he sounded awful tired.
What?
You gotta get a baby book. Something that tells you how to take care of them. Like the manual to a car. Because you keep forgetting things.
Okay, George.
You better get a newspaper, too. Only don't buy them too close to here. Buy them someplace bigger.
George?
What?
Who's gonna take care of the kid while I'm gone?
There was a long pause. One so long Blaze thought George had gone away again. Then he said,
I will. Blaze frowned.
You can't, George. You're...
I said, I will. Now get your ass in there and feed him.
But if the kid gets in trouble, chokes or something, and I'm gone...
Feed him, goddammit.
Okay, George, sure.
He went into the other room. Joe was fussing and kicking on the bed, still chewing his fingers. Blaze burped the bottle the way the lady showed him, pushing a finger up inside the plastic bag until a drop of milk formed on the nipple. He sat down by the baby and carefully removed Joe's fingers from his mouth. Joe started to cry, but when Blaze put the rubber nipple where his fingers had been, the lips closed over it and he began to suck. The small cheeks went in and out.
That's right, Blaze said. That's right, you little bagger.
Joe drank all of it. When Blaze picked him up to burp him, he spit a little back, getting some on the shirt of Blaze's thermal underwear. Blaze didn't mind. He wanted to change the baby into one of his new outfits anyway. He told himself he only wanted to see if it fit. It did. When Blaze was done with that, he took off his own top and smelled the baby's burp up. It smelled vaguely cheesy. Maybe, he thought, the milk was still a little too thick. Or maybe he should have stopped and burped the kid halfway through the bottle. George was right. He needed a book. He looked down at Joe. The baby had bunched a small piece of blanket in his hands and was examining it. He was a cute little shit. They were going to be worried about him, Joe Girard III and his wife, probably thinking the kid had been tucked away in a bureau drawer, screaming and hungry with crappy diapers, or worse still, lying in a shallow hole chipped out of frozen earth, a tiny scrap of man-child gasping away its last few breaths in frozen vapor, then into a green plastic hefty bag. Where had he gotten that idea?
George.
George had said that. He had been talking about the Lindbergh snatch. The kidnapper's name had been Hopeman, Hopman, something like that.
George? George? Don't hurt him while I'm gone.
No answer. He heard the first item on the news while he was making his breakfast. Joe was on the floor, on a blanket Blaze had spread for him. He was playing with one of George's newspapers. He had pulled a tent of it over his head and was kicking with excitement. The announcer had just finished telling about a Republican senator who had taken a bribe. Blaze was hoping George heard it. George likes stuff like that.
Topping area news is an apparent kidnapping in Ocoma Heights, the announcer said.
Blaze stopped stirring his potatoes around in the frying pan and listened carefully.
Joseph Girard IV, infant heir to the Girard shipping fortune, was taken from the Girard's Ocoma Heights estate either late last night or early this morning. A sister of Joseph Girard, the boy's great-grandfather, once known as the boy wonder of American shipping, was found unconscious on the kitchen floor by the family cook early this morning. Norma Girard, said to be in her mid-70s, was taken to the main medical center where her condition is listed as critical. When asked if he had called for FBI assistance, Castle County Sheriff John D. Kelleher said he could not comment at this time. He would also not comment on the possibility of a ransom note.
Oh, yeah, Blaze thought. I gotta send one of those.
But he did say police have a number of leads, which are being actively investigated.
Like what? Blaze wondered, and smiled a little. They always said stuff like that. What leads could they have if the old lady was El Zonko? He had even taken the ladder with him. They said stuff like that, that was all. He ate his breakfast on the floor and played with the baby. When he got ready to go out that afternoon, the kid had been fed and freshly changed and lay sleeping in the cradle. Blaze had tinkered with the formula a little more, and this time had burped him halfway through. It worked real good. It worked like a charm. He'd also changed the kid's diapers. At first, all that green shit had scared him, but then he remembered. Peas.
George, I'm going now.
Okay, George said from the bedroom.
You better come out here and watch him in case he wakes up.
I will, don't worry.
Yeah, Blaze said, without conviction. George was dead. He was talking to a dead man. He was asking a dead man to babysit.
Hey, George, maybe I oughta...
Oughta, schmoughta, coulda, woulda. Go on, get out of here.
George...
Go on, I said. Roll.
Blaze went. The day was bright and sparkling and a little warmer. After a week of single-number temperatures, 20 degrees felt like a heat wave. But there was no pleasure in the sunshine. No pleasure to be had in driving the back roads to Portland. He didn't trust George with the baby. He didn't know why, but he sure didn't. Because, see, now George was a part of himself, and he most likely took all the parts with him when he went somewhere, even the George part. Didn't that make sense? Blaze thought it did. And then he started wondering about the wood stove. What if the house burned down? This morbid picture entered his head and wouldn't leave. A chimney fire from the stove he'd stoked, special so Joe wouldn't be cold if he kicked off his blanket. Sparks sputtering from the chimney onto the roof. Most dying, but one spark finding a dry shingle and catching hot, reaching out to the explosively dry clapboards beneath. The flames then racing across the beams, the baby beginning to cry as the first tendrils of smoke grew thicker and thicker. He suddenly realized he had pushed the stolen Ford up to 70. He eased off the accelerator. That was worse, and more of it. He parked in the Casco Street lot, gave the attendant a couple of bucks, and went around to Walgreens. He picked up an evening express, then went to the rack of paperbacks by the soda fountain. A lot of westerns, gothics, mysteries, science fiction. And then, on the bottom shelf, a thick book with a smiling, hairless baby on the cover. He worked out the title quickly. There were no hard words in it. Child and Baby Care. There was a picture of an old dude surrounded by kids on the back cover, probably the guy who wrote it. He paid for his stuff and shook open the newspaper going out the door. He stopped suddenly on the sidewalk, mouth open. There was a picture of him on the front page. Not a photo, he saw with relief, but a police drawing. One of those they made with identikits. It wasn't even that good. They didn't have the bashed-in place in his forehead. His eyes were the wrong shape. His lips were nowhere near that thick. But somehow it was still recognizably him. The old lady must have woken up then. Only the subheading did away with that idea and in a hurry. FBI enters search for baby nappers. Norma Gerard succumbs to head injury. Special to the Evening Express. By James T. Mears. The man who drove the getaway car in the Gerard baby kidnapping, and possibly the only kidnapper, is pictured on this page in an Evening Express exclusive. The drawing was made by Portland PD sketch artist John Black from a description given by Morton Walsh, a night attendant at Oakwood, a new high-rise condominium tower a quarter of a mile from the Gerard family compound. Walsh told Portland police and Castle County sheriff's deputies earlier today that the suspect said he was visiting Joseph Carlton, a name that is apparently fictitious. The suspected baby napper was driving a blue Ford sedan, and Walsh said there was a ladder in the back. Walsh is being held as a material witness, and there is speculation about his failure to question the driver more closely on his intentions, given the lateness of the hour, approximately 2 a.m. A source close to the investigation has suggested that the Joseph Carlton mystery apartment may have ties to organized crime, raising the possibility that the infant kidnapping could have been a well-organized criminal caper. Neither FBI agents, now on scene, nor local police would comment on this possibility. There are other leads at the present time, although no ransom letter or call has been announced. One of the kidnappers may have left blood at the crime scene,
possibly from a cut received in his scramble over the Oakwood parking lot fence, which is one of the chain-link type. Sheriff John D. Kelleher called it one more strand in the rope that will eventually hang this man, or gang of men. In other developments, Norma Gerard, the kidnapped boy's great-great-aunt, succumbed during an operation at Maine Medical Center to relieve pressure on her. Go to page 2, column 5.
Blaze turned to page 2, but there wasn't much there. If the cops had other stuff, they were holding it back. There was a picture of the kidnap house and another of where the baby nappers entered. There was a small box that said, "Appeal to kidnappers from father, page 6. Blaze didn't turn to page 6. The time always got away from him when he was reading, and he couldn't afford that now. He'd been away too long already. It would take him at least another 45 minutes to get home, and also the car was hot. Walsh, that miserable bastard. Blaze almost hoped the organization whacked the miserable bastard for blowing their apartment. Meantime, he would just have to take his chances. Maybe he could get back okay. Things would be a lot worse if he just left the car and had his fingerprints all over it, what George called dabs. Maybe they had the license plate number, though. Maybe Walsh had written it down. He turned this over slowly and carefully, and decided Walsh wouldn't have written it down. Probably. Still, they knew it was a Ford, and blue. But of course it had been green originally, before he painted it. Maybe that would make a difference. Maybe it would still be okay. Maybe not. It was hard to know. He approached the parking lot carefully, lurking his way up to it. But he saw no cops, and the attendant was reading a magazine. That was good. Blaze got in, started the Ford up, and waited for cops to descend from 100 hiding places. None did. When he drove out, the attendant took the yellow ticket from under his windshield wiper with hardly a glance. Getting clear of Portland and then Westbrook seemed to take forever. It was a little bit like driving with an open jug of wine between your legs, only worse. He was sure that every car that pulled up close behind him was an unmarked police car. He actually saw only one copmobile on his trip out of the city, crossing the intersection of Routes 1 and 25, breaking trail for an ambulance with its siren howling and its lights flashing. Seeing that actually comforted him. A police car like that, you knew what it was. After Westbrook dropped behind, he swung off onto a secondary road, then onto two-lane blacktop that turned to frozen dirt and wound cross-country through the woods to Apex. He did not feel entirely safe even there, and when he turned into the long driveway leading to the shack, he felt as if great weights were dropping off his body. He drove the Ford into the shed and told himself it could stay there until hell was a skating rink. He had known that kidnapping was big and that things would be hot, but this was scorching. The picture, the blood he'd left behind, the quick and painless way that glorified doorman had given up the organization's private playpen. But all those thoughts faded as soon as he got out of the car. Joe was screaming. Blaze could hear him even outside. He ran across the dooryard and burst into the house. George had done something. But George hadn't done anything. George wasn't anywhere around. George was dead, and he, Blaze, had left the baby all alone. The cradle was rocking with the force of the baby's anger, and when Blaze got to Joe, he saw why. The kid had thrown up most of his 10 o'clock bottle, and rancid, reeking milk, half dry, was lathered on his face and soaking into his pajama top. His face was an awful plum color. Sweat stood out on it in beads. In a kind of shutter frame, Blaze saw his own father, a hulking giant with red eyes and big hurting hands. The picture left him agonized with guilt and horror. He had not thought of his father in years. He snatched the baby out of the cradle with such suddenness that Joe's head rolled on his neck. He stopped crying out of surprise as much as anything. "There," Blaze crooned, beginning to walk around the room with the baby on his shoulder. "There, there, I'm back. Yes, I am. There, there. Don't cry no more. I'm right here,
Right here.
The baby fell asleep before Blaze had made 3 full turns around the room. Blaze changed him, doing the diapers faster than before, buttoned him up, and popped him back in the cradle. Then he sat down to think, to really think this time. What came next? A ransom note, right? Right, he said. Make it out of letters from magazines. That was how they did it in the movies. He got a stack of newspapers, girly magazines, and comic books. Then he began to cut out letters. I have the baby. There, that was a good start. He went over to the window and turned on the radio and got Ferlin Husky singing Wings of a Dove. That was a good one, an oldie but a goodie. He rummaged around until he found a tablet of high-toned paper George had bought in Rennie's, and then mixed up some flour and water paste. He hummed along with the music as he worked. It was a rusted grating sound, like an old gate swinging on bad hinges. He went back to the table and pasted on the letters he had so far. A thought struck him. Did paper take fingerprints? He didn't know, but it didn't seem very possible. Better not to take chances, though. He crumpled up the paper with the letters pasted on it and found George's leather gloves. They were too small for him, but he stretched them on. Then he hunted out the same letters all over again and pasted them up. I have the baby. The news came on. He listened carefully and heard that somebody had called the Girard home demanding $2,000 in ransom. This made Blaze frown. Then the newscaster said a teenage boy had made the call from a phone booth in Wyndham. The police had traced the call. When they caught him, he said he had been playing a prank. Tell them it's a prank all night. They'll still put you away, kiddo, Blaze thought. Kidnapping is hot. He frowned, thought, cut out more letters. The weather forecast came on, fair and a little colder, snow on the way soon. I have the baby. If you want to see him alive again... If you want to see him alive again, what? What? Confusion rose in Blaze's mind. Call collect. Operators are standing by. Stand on your head and whistle Dixie. Send 2 box tops and 50 cents in coin. How did you go about getting the dough without getting caught? George, I can't remember this part. No answer. He put his chin in one hand and really put on his thinking cap. He had to be very cool. Cool like George. Cool like John Chelsman had been that day in the bus station when they had been running away to Boston. You had to use your nut. You had to use your old bean. He would have to pretend he was part of a gang. That was for sure. Then they couldn't grab him when he picked up the swag. If they did... He'd tell them they had to let him go or his partners would kill the kid. Run a bluff. Hell, run a con. That's how we roll, he whispered. Right, George? He crumpled up a second try and searched out more letters, scissoring them into neat blocks. Our gang has the baby. If you want to see him alive again... That was good. That was right on the jack. Blaze admired it for a while, then went back to check the baby. The baby was asleep. His head was turned, and one small fist was tucked under his cheek. His lashes were very long and darker than his hair. Blaze liked him. He never would have said a rug monkey could be good-looking, but this one was. You're a stud, Joey, he said, and then ruffled the baby's hair. His hand was bigger than the baby's whole head. Blaze went back to the scattered magazines and newspapers and scraps on the table. He deliberated a while, nibbling a little of his flour water paste as he did. Then he got back to work. Our gang has the baby. If you want to see him alive again, get $1 million in unmarked bills. Put money in briefcase. Be ready to go on a moment's notice. Sincerely yours... The Kidnappers of Joe Girard 4. There, it told them some stuff, but not too much, and it would give him some time to think out a plan. He found a dirty old envelope and put his letter in it, then cut out letters on the front to say, the Gerards, Okoma, important. He didn't know exactly how he was going to mail it. He didn't want to leave the baby with George again, and he didn't dare use the hot Ford. But he didn't want to mail it in Apex, either. Everything would have been so much easier with George. He could have just stayed home and babysat while George took care of the brain stuff. He wouldn't mind feeding Joe and changing him and all that stuff. He wouldn't mind a bit. He sort of liked it. Well, it didn't matter. The mail wouldn't go out until tomorrow morning anyway, so he had time to make a plan, or remember George's. He got up and checked the baby again, wishing the TV wasn't bust. You got good ideas from the TV sometimes. Joe was still sleeping. Blaze wished he would wake up so that he could play with him, make him grin. The kid looked like a real boy when he grinned, and he was dressed now so Blaze could goof with him and not worry about getting pissed on. Still, he was asleep, and there was no help for that. Blaze turned off the radio and went into the bedroom to make plans, but he fell asleep himself. Before drifting off, it occurred to him that he felt sort of good. For the first time since George died, he felt sort of good. Chapter 14. He was at a carnival, maybe the Topsom Fair, where the boys from Hetton House were allowed to go once each year on the rickety old blue bus, and Joe was on his shoulder. He felt fog-like terror as he walked down the midway, because pretty soon they would spot him, and it would be all over. Joe was awake. When they passed one of the funny mirrors that stretched you thin, Blaze saw the kid goggling at everything. Blaze kept walking, shifting Joe from one shoulder to the other when he got heavy, keeping an eye out for the cops at the same time. All around him, the carnival rolled in unhealthy neon majesty. From the right came the amplified beat of a pitchman's voice. "Come on over here! Got it all over here! 6 beautiful girls, 6 honeys! They all come straight from Club Diablo in Boston! These girls will tease you, please you, make you think you're in gay Paris!" "This ain't no place for a kid," Blaze thought. "This is the last place in the world for a little kid." On the left was the House of Fun, with its mechanical clown out front, rocking back and forth in clock-spring gales of hilarity. Its mouth was turned upward in an expression of humor so large it was like a grimace of pain. Its lunatic laugh played over and over again from a tape loop buried deep in its guts. A huge man with a blue anchor tattooed on one bicep threw hard rubber balls at wooden milk bottles stacked in a pyramid. His slicked back hair gleamed under the colored lights like an otter's hide. The wild mouse rose and then went into a clattering dive, trailing the shrieks of country girls packed into tube tops and short skirts. The moon rocket rolled up, down, and all around. The faces of the riders stretched into goblin masks by the speed of the thing. A babble of odors rose: French fries, vinegar, tacos, popcorn, chocolate, fried clams, pizza, peppers, beer. The midway was a flat brown tongue, littered with 1,000 shucked wrappers and 1,000,000 stamped cigarette butts. Under the glare of the lights, all faces were flat and grotesque. An old man with a runner of a green snot hanging from his nose walked past, eating a candy apple. Then a boy with a plum-colored birthmark swarming up one cheek. An old black woman beneath a blonde beehive wig. A fat man in Bermuda shorts with varicose veins, wearing a T-shirt saying, "Property of the Brunswick Dragons." "Joe!" someone was calling. "Joe! Joe!" Blaze turned and tried to pinpoint the voice from the crowd, and then he saw her, wearing that same nightgown with her cakes practically falling out of the lace top. Joe's pretty young mother. Terror seized him. She was going to see him. She couldn't help but see him. And when she did, she would take his baby away. He held Joe tighter, as if embrace could ensure possession. The little body was warm and reassuring. He could feel the flutter of the child's life against his chest. "There!" Mrs. Gerard screamed. "There he is!
The man who stole my baby! Get him! Catch him! Give me back my baby!"
People turned to look. Blaze was near the merry-go-round now, and the calliope music was huge. It bounded and echoed.
"Stop him! Stop that man! Stop the baby thief!"
The man with the tattoo and the slicked back hair began to walk toward him, and now, at last, Blaze could run. But the midway had grown longer. It stretched away for miles, an endless highway of fun. And they were all behind him. The boy with the swarming birthmark, the black woman in her blonde wig, the fat man in the Bermuda shorts, the mechanical clown laughed and laughed. Blaze ran past another pitchman, who was standing beside a huge guy wearing what looked like an animal skin. The sign over his head billed him as Leopard Man. The pitchman raised his microphone and began to speak. His amplified voice rolled down the midway like thunder.
"Hooray, hooray, hooray, you're just in time to see Clayton Blaisdell Jr., the noted baby napper. Lay that kid down, fella. He's right over here, folks, direct from Apex, where he lives on the Parker Road, and the hot car is stashed in the shed out back. Hurry, hurry, hurry. See the live baby napper right here."
He ran faster, breath sobbing in and out, but they were gaining. He looked back and saw that Joe's mother was leading the posse. Her face was changing. It was growing paler, except for her lips. They were getting redder. Her teeth were growing down over them. Her fingers were hooking into red-tipped claws. She was becoming the bride of Yorga.
"Get him! Catch him! Kill him! The baby napper!"
Then George was hissing at him from the shadows.
"In here, Blaze, quick! Move, goddammit!"
He veered in the direction of the voice and found himself in the mirror maze. The midway was suddenly broken up into a thousand distorted pieces. He bumped and thrust his way down the narrow corridor, panting like a dog. Then George was in front of him, and behind him, and to either side of him. And George was saying,
"You have to make them drop it from a plane, Blaze. From a plane. Make them drop it from a plane."
"I can't get out," Blaze moaned. "George, help me get out."
"That's what I'm trying to do, asshole. Make them drop it from a plane."
They were all outside now, and peering in, but the mirrors made it seem as if they were all around him.
"Get the baby napper,"
Gerard's wife shrieked. Her teeth were now huge.
"Help me, George."
Then George smiled, and Blaze saw that his teeth were long, too. Too long.
"I'll help you," he said. "Give me the baby."
But Blaze didn't. Blaze backed away. A million Georges advanced on him, holding out their hands to take the baby. Blaze turned and plunged down another glittering aisle, bouncing from side to side like a pinball, trying to hold Joe protectively. This was no place for a kid. Chapter 15. Blaze came awake in the first thin light of dawn. At first, not sure where he was. Then everything came back, and he collapsed on his side, breathing hard. His bed was drenched in sweat. Christ, what an awful dream. He got up and padded into the kitchen to check on the baby. Joe was deeply asleep, lips pursed, as if he was having big, serious thoughts. Blaze looked at him until his eyes picked up the slow, steady rise of the kid's chest. His lips moved, and Blaze wondered if Joe was dreaming about the bottle or his mother's titty. Then he put on the coffee and sat down at the table in his long underwear. The paper he had bought yesterday was still there amid the scraps of his kidnap note. He began to read the story about the kidnapping again, and his eye once more fell on the box at the bottom of page 2. Appeal to Kidnappers from Father, page 6. Blaze turned over to page 6, where he found a half-page broadside outlined in black. He read, "To the people who have our child, we will meet any demands on condition that you can provide us with evidence that Joe is still alive. We have the guarantee of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI,
that there will be no interference with your collection of the ransom, but we must have proof that Joe is alive. He is eating 3 times a day, canned baby dinners and veg followed by 1/2 a bottle. The formula he's used to is canned milk and boiled sterilized water in a ratio of 1 to 1. Please do not hurt him, because we love him so very much. Joseph Girard III. Blaze closed the newspaper. Reading that made him feel unhappy, like hearing Loretta Lynn sing, "Your good girl's gonna go bad."
"Oh, jeez, boo-hoo,"
George said so suddenly from the bedroom that Blaze jumped.
"Shh, you wake him up."
"Fuck that," George said. "He can't hear me."
"Oh," Blaze said. He guessed that was true.
"What's a radio, George? It says make him his bottles in a radio of 1-something-1.
"Never mind," George said. "Really worried about him, aren't they? He is eating 3 times a day, followed by 1/2 a bottle. Don't hurt him, 'cause we love him, love him, love him. Man, this piles the pink horseshit to a new high."
"Listen," Blaze began.
"No, I won't listen. Don't tell me to listen. He's all they have, right? That and about 40 million smackerinis. Ought to get the money and then send the kid back in pieces. First a finger, then a toe, then his little—"
"George, you shut up!"
He clapped a hand over his mouth, shocked. He had just told George to shut up. What was he thinking about? What was wrong with him? "George?" No answer. "George? I'm sorry. It's just that you shouldn't say things, you know, like that." He tried to smile. "We have to give the kid back alive, right? That's the plan, right?" No answer. And now Blaze started to feel really miserable. "George? George, what's wrong?" No answer for a long time. Then so softly he might not have heard it. So softly it might have only been a thought in his own head.
"You'll have to leave him with me, Blaze. Sooner or later."
Blaze wiped his mouth with the palm of his hand.
"You better not do anything to him, George. You just better not. I'm warning you."
No answer. By 9 o'clock, Joe was up, changed, fed, and playing on the kitchen floor. Blaze was sitting at the table and listening to the radio. He had cleared off the scraps of paper and thrown out the hardened flour paste, and the only thing on the table was his letter to the Girards. He was trying to figure out how to mail it. He had heard the news 3 times. The police had picked up a man named Charles Victor Pritchett, a big drifter from Aroostook County, who had been laid off some sawmill job a month earlier. Then he had been released. Probably that scrawny little door-opener Walsh couldn't make him for it, Blaze reasoned. Too bad. A good suspect would have taken the heat off for a while. He shifted restlessly in his chair. He had to get this kidnapping off the ground. He had to make a plan about mailing the letter. They had a drawing of him, and they knew about the car. They even knew about the color. That bastard Walsh again. His mind moved slowly and heavily. He got up, made more coffee, then got out the newspaper again. He frowned at the police sketch of himself. Big, square-jawed face, broad, flat nose, thick shock of hair, hadn't been cut in quite a while. George had done it last time, snipping away indifferently with a pair of kitchen shears. Deep-set eyes. Only a suggestion of his big old neck, and they probably wouldn't have any idea of how big he really was. People never did when he was sitting down, because his legs were the longest part of him. Joe began to cry, and Blaze heated a bottle. The baby pushed it away, so Blaze dandled him absently on his lap. Joe quieted at once and began to stare around at things from his new elevation. The 3 pinups on the far side of the room, the greasy asbestos shield screwed into the wall behind the stove, the windows dirty on the inside and frosty on the outside.
"Not much like where you came from, huh?"
Blaze asked. Joe smiled, then tried his strange, unpracticed laugh that made Blaze grin. The little guy had two teeth, their tops just peeking through the gums. Blaze wondered if some of the others struggling to come through were giving him trouble. Joe chewed his hands a lot, and sometimes whined in his sleep. Now he began to drool, and Blaze wiped his mouth with an old Kleenex that was wadded up in his pocket. He couldn't leave the baby with George again. It was like George was jealous or something. Almost like George wanted to... He might have stiffened, because Joe looked around at him with a funny, questioning expression, like, "What's up with you, buddy?" Blaze hardly noticed, because the thing was, now he was George. And that meant that part of him wanted to... Again, he shied away from it, and when he did, his troubled mind found something else to seize on. If he went somewhere, George went somewhere too. If he was George now, that only made sense. A leads to B, simple as can be, Johnny Cheltzman would have said. If he went, George went. Which meant that George was powerless to hurt Joe, no matter how much he might want to. Something inside him loosened. He still didn't like the idea of leaving the baby, but better to leave him alone than with somebody who might hurt him. And besides, he had to do it. There was no one else. But he could sure use a disguise, with them having that drawing of him and all. Something like a nylon stocking, only natural. What? An idea came to him. It didn't come in a flash, but slowly. It rose in his mind like a bubble rising to the surface of water so thick it's nearly mud. He put Joe back on the floor, then went into the bathroom. He laid out scissors and a towel. Then he got George's Norelco shaver out from the medicine cabinet, where it had been sleeping all these months with the cord wrapped around it. He cut his hair in big, unlovely bunches, cut until what was left stuck up in bristly patches. Then he plugged in the Norelco and shaved off those, too. He went back and forth until the electric razor was hot in his hand, and his newly nude scalp was pink with irritation. He regarded his image in the mirror curiously. The dent in his brow showed more clearly than ever, all of it uncovered for the first time in years. And it was sort of horrible to look at. It looked almost deep enough to hold a cup of coffee if he was lying on his back. But otherwise, Blaze didn't think he looked much like the crazed baby napper in the police sketch. He looked like some foreign guy, from Germany, or Berlin, or someplace. But his eyes, they were still the same. What if his eyes gave him away? George has shades, he said. That's the ticket, isn't it? He vaguely realized he was actually making himself more conspicuous rather than less. But maybe that was all right. What else could he do anyway? He couldn't help being 6 foot whatever. All he could do was try and make his looks work for him rather than against him. He certainly didn't realize that he had done a better job of disguise than George ever could have, no more than he realized that George was now the creation of a mind working at a feverish, half-crazed pitch below the burnt-out surface of stupidity. For years he had identified himself as a dummy, coming to accept it as just one more part of his life, like the dent in his forehead. Yet something continued to work away beneath the burnt-out surface. It worked with the deadly instinct of living things, moles, worms, microbes, beneath the surface of a burnt-over meadow. This was the part that remembered everything, every hurt, every cruelty, every bad turn the world had done him. He was hiking at a good pace along the apex back road when an old pulp truck with an oversized load wheezed up beside him. The man inside was grizzled and wearing a thermal undershirt under a checkered wool coat. "Climb up," he bawled. Blaze swung onto the running board and then climbed into the cab, said thank you. The driver nodded and said, "Going to Westbrook." Blaze nodded back and gave the guy a thumbs up. The driver clashed the gears and the truck began to roll again, not as if it particularly wanted to.
"Seen you before, ain't I?"
the trucker shouted over the flailing motor. His window was broken, and blasts of cold January air whirled in, fighting with the baking air from the heater.
"Live on Palmer Road?"
"Yeah,"
Blaze shouted back.
"Jimmy Cullen used to live out there,"
the trucker said, and offered Blaze an incredibly battered package of Luckies. Blaze took one.
"Some guy," Blaze said.
His newly bald head did not show. He was wearing a red knitted cap.
"Went down south, Jimmy did. Say, your buddy still around?"
Blaze realized he must mean George.
"Nah," he said. "He found work in New Hampshire."
"Yeah?" the trucker said. "Wish he'd find me some."
They had reached the top of the hill, and now the truck began down the other side, picking up speed along the rutted washboard, banging and clobbering. Blaze could almost feel the illegal load pushing them. He had driven overweight pulp trucks himself, had once taken a load of Christmas trees to Massachusetts that had to have been half a ton over the limit. It had never worried him before, but it did now. It dawned on him that only he stood between Joe and death. After they'd gotten on the main road, the driver mentioned the kidnapping. Blaze tensed a little, but he wasn't particularly surprised.
"They find the guy grabbed that kid, they oughta string him up by his balls," the pulper offered.
He shifted up to third with a hellish grinding of gears.
"I guess so," Blaze said. "It's getting as bad as those plane hijacks, remember those?"
"Yep."
He didn't. The driver tossed the stub of his cigarette out the window and immediately lit another one.
"It's got to stop. They ought to have mandatory death penalties for guys like that. A firing squad, maybe."
"You think they'll get the guy?" Blaze asked.
He was starting to feel like a spy in a movie.
"Does the Pope wear a tall hat?" the driver asked, turning onto Route 1.
"I guess so."
"What I mean is, it goes without saying. Of course they'll get him. They always do. But the kid'll be dead, and you can quote me on that."
"Oh, I don't know," Blaze said.
"Yeah, well, I know. Whole idea's crazy. Kidnapping in this day and age. The FBI'll mark the bills or copy the serial numbers or put invisible marks on them, the kind you can only see with an ultraviolet light."
"I guess so," Blaze said, feeling troubled.
He hadn't thought about those sorts of things. Still, if he was going to sell the money in Boston to that guy George knew, what did it matter? He started to feel better again.
"You think those Gerards will really fork over $1 million?"
The driver whistled.
"Is that how much they're asking?"
Blaze felt in that moment as if he could gladly have bitten off his own tongue and swallowed it.
"Yeah," he said,
and thought, "Oh, George."
"That's something new," the driver said. "Wasn't in the morning paper. Did you hear about it on the radio?"
George said quite clearly,
"Kill him, Blaze."
The driver cupped his hand to his ear.
"What? Didn't quite get that."
"I said, yeah, on the radio."
He looked down at his hands, folded in his lap. They were big hands, powerful. One of them had broken a collie's neck with a single blow. And back then he hadn't even had his growth.
"They might get that ransom," the driver said, flipping out his second cigarette butt and lighting a third. "But they'll never get to spend it. No, sir. Not never."
They were headed up Route 1 now, past frozen marshes and clam shacks shuttered for the winter. The trucker was avoiding the turnpike and the weighing stations there. Blaze didn't blame him. If I hit him right in the throat where his Adam's apple is, he'd wake up in heaven before he even knew he was dead, Blaze thought. Then I could grab the wheel and pull him over, prop him up on the passenger side. Anyone who sees him will think he's just catching him a little catnap.
Poor fella, they'll think. He was probably driving all...
Going?
Huh? Blaze asked.
I said, where are you going? I forgot.
Oh. Westbrook.
Well, I gotta swing off on Mara Road, a mile up. Meeting a buddy, you know.
Oh, Blaze said. Yeah. And George said,
You gotta do it now, Blazer. Right time, right place. It's how we roll.
So Blaze turned toward the driver.
How about another cigarette? The driver asked. You interested?
He cocked his head a little as he spoke, offering a perfect target. Blaze stiffened a little. His hands twitched in his lap. Then he said,
No, trying to quit. Yeah? Good for you. Cold as a witch's tit in here, ain't it?
The driver downshifted in anticipation of his turn, and from below them came a series of barking explosions as the engine backfired down its rotting tailpipe.
Heaters broke. Radio, too.
Too bad, Blaze said. His throat felt as if someone had just fed him a spoonful of dust.
Yeah. Life sucks, and then you die.
He applied the brakes. They screamed like souls in pain.
You have to hit the ground running. Sorry, but she stalls out in first.
Sure, Blaze said. Now that the moment had come and gone, he felt sick to his stomach and afraid. He wished he had never seen the driver.
Say hi to your buddy when you see him, the driver said,
and downshifted another gear as the overloaded truck swerved onto what Blaze assumed was Mara Road. Blaze opened the door and jumped out onto the frozen shoulder, slamming the door behind him. The driver honked his horn once, and then the truck roared over the hill in a cloud of stinking exhaust. Soon it was just a sound, dwindling away. Blaze started up Route 1 with his hands jammed in his pockets. He was in the ex-urban sprawl south of Portland, and in a mile or two he came to a big shopping center with stores and a cinema complex. There was a laundromat there, called the Giant Clean Clothes You Wash It. There was a mailbox in front of the laundromat, and there he mailed his ransom note. There was a newspaper dispenser inside. He went in to get one.
Look, Ma,
a little kid said to his mother, who was unloading clean clothes from a coin-op dryer.
That guy's got a hole in his head.
Hush, the kid's mother said. Blaze smiled at the boy, who immediately hid behind his mother's leg. From this place of safety, he peered out and up. Blaze got his paper and went out with it. A hotel fire had pushed the kidnap story to the bottom of page one. But the sketch of him was still there. Search for kidnappers goes on, the headline said. He stuffed the newspaper in his back pocket. It was a bummer. While cutting across the parking lot to the road, he spotted an old Mustang with the keys in it. Without giving it much thought, Blaze got in and drove it away. Chapter 16 Clayton Blaisdell Jr. became the prime suspect in the kidnapping at 4:30 p.m. on that same gray January afternoon, about an hour and a half after he dropped his letter into the mailbox in front of the Giant Clean Clothes You Wash It. There was a break in the case, as law enforcement officials like to say. But even before the phone call that came to the FBI number listed in that day's story about the snatch, ID had become only a matter of time. The police had a wealth of information. There was the description given by Morton Walsh, whose ass would be canned by his Boston employers as soon as the Fuhrer died down. There were a number of blue threads plucked from the top of the chain-link fence surrounding the Oakwood Visitors parking lot, identified as being from D-Boy Jeans, a discount brand. There were photos and casts of boot treads with distinctive wear patterns. There was a blood sample, type AB, RH negative. There were photos and casts of the feet of an extendable ladder, now identified as a Kraftwerk Lightweight Supreme. There were photographs of boot prints inside the house, featuring the same distinctive wear patterns. And there was a dying declaration by Norma Girard, identifying the police artist's sketch as a reasonable likeness of the man who had assaulted her. Before lapsing into a coma, she had added one detail that Walsh had left out. The man had a massive dent in his forehead, as if he had once been hit there with a brick or a length of pipe. Very little of this information had been given to the press. Other than the dent in the forehead, investigators were particularly interested in two facts. First, D-Boy jeans were sold at only a few dozen outlets in northern New England. Second, and even better, Kraftwerk Ladders was a small Vermont company that wholesaled only to independent hardware stores. No Ames, no Mammoth Mart, no Kmart. A small army of officers began visiting these independent dealers. They had not reached Apex Hardware, the helpful place, on the day Blaze mailed his letter. But it was now only a matter of hours before they did. At the Girard home, traceback equipment had been installed. Joseph Girard IV's father had been carefully coached on how to handle the inevitable call when it came. Joe's mother was upstairs, stuffed with tranks. None of the law enforcement officials were under any orders to take the kidnapper or kidnappers alive. Forensic experts estimated that one of the men they were after, maybe the only man, stood at least 6 feet 4 inches tall and weighed in the 250 range. The fractured skull of Norma Girard offered testimony, if any were needed, of his strength and brutality. Then at 4:30 p.m. on that gray day, Special Agent in Charge Albert Sterling got a call from Nancy Muldow. As soon as Sterling and his partner, Bruce Granger, stepped into the baby shop, Nancy Muldow said, "There's something wrong with your picture. The man you want has a big hole in the middle of his forehead."
"Yes, ma'am," Sterling said. "We're holding that back."
Her eyes got round. "So he won't know that you know."
"That's correct."
She gestured to the young fellow standing next to her. He was wearing a blue nylon duster, a red bow tie, and a thrilled look. "This is Brandt. He helped him out with the things he bought."
"Full name?"
Agent Granger asked the kid in the blue duster. He opened his notebook. The stock boy's Adam's apple went up and down like a monkey on a stick.
"Brandt Romano, sir. That guy was driving a Ford."
He named the year with what Sterling deemed to be a high degree of confidence.
"Only it wasn't blue, like it says in the paper. It was green."
Sterling turned to Muldow.
"What did this man buy, ma'am?"
She actually laughed a little. "My laws, what didn't he? All baby things, of course. That's what we sell here. A crib, a cradle, a changing table, clothes, the works. He even bought a single-place serving."
"Do you have a complete list?" Granger asked.
"Of course. I never suspected he was up to something awful. He actually seemed like a nice enough man. Although that dented place in his forehead, that hole..."
Granger nodded sympathetically.
"And he didn't seem terribly bright, but bright enough to fool me, I guess. He said he was buying things for a little nephew, and silly Nan believed him."
"And he was big."
"My laws, a giant! It was like being with
She trilled nervous laughter.
"A bull in a baby shop!"
"How big?" She shrugged.
"I'm 5'4". And I only came up to his ribs. That would make him..."
"You probably won't believe this," said Brandt, the stock boy, "but I thought he had to be like 6'7", maybe even 6'8".
Sterling prepared to ask a final question. He had saved it for last because he was almost sure it would lead to a dead end.
"Mrs. Muldow, how did this man pay for his purchases?"
"Cash," she said promptly.
"I see." He looked at Granger. It was the answer they had expected.
"You should have seen all the cash he had in his wallet."
"Spent most of it," Brandt said. "He tipped me 5, but by then the cupboard was mostly, like, bare."
Sterling ignored this.
"And since it was a cash purchase, you don't have any record of the man's name?"
"No, no record. Hagers will get around to putting in security cameras in a few years, I suppose."
"Centuries," said Brandt. "This place is, like, cheap to the max."
"Well, then," Sterling said, flipping his notebook closed, "we'll be going. But I want to give you my card in case you think of any—"
"I do happen to know his name," Nancy Muldow said.
They both turned back to her. When he opened his wallet to take out that big stack of money, I saw his driver's license. I remember the name partly because that kind of sale is a once-in-a-lifetime thing, but mostly because it was such a stately name. It didn't seem to fit him. I remember thinking that a man like him should be named Barney or Fred. You know, like on the Flintstones.
What was the name? Sterling asked.
Clayton Blaisdell. In fact, I think it was Clayton Blaisdell Jr. By 5:30 that evening, they had their man tabbed. Clayton Blaisdell Jr., a.k.a. Blaze, had been popped twice, once for assault and battery against the headmaster of the state home where the kid was living, a place called Hetton House, and once more years later for bunco and fraud. A suspected accomplice, George Thomas Rackley, a.k.a. Rasp, had gotten off because Blaze wouldn't testify against him. According to police files, Blaisdell and Rackley had been a team for at least 8 years before Blaisdell's fall on the bunco rap, which had been a religious con just a little too complex for the big boy's limited mental talents. At South Portland Correctional, he had taken an IQ test and scored low enough to be placed in a category called borderline restricted. In the margin, someone had written in big red letters, retarded. Sterling found the details of the con itself quite amusing. In the gag, there was a big man in a wheelchair, Blaisdell, and a little guy pushing him who introduced himself to Marx as the Reverend Gary Crowell, almost certainly Rackley. The Reverend Gary, as he styled himself, claimed to be raising money for a revivalist swing through Japan. If the Marx, mostly old ladies with a little stashed in the bank, proved hard to convince, the Reverend Gary performed a miracle. He caused the big guy in the wheelchair to walk again, through the power of Jesus. The circumstances of the arrest were even more amusing. An octogenarian named Arlene Merrill got suspicious and called the police while the Reverend Gary and his assistant were in the living room. Then she walked back to the living room to talk to them until the police arrived. The Reverend Gary smelled it and took off. Blaisdell stayed. In his report, the arresting officer wrote, "Suspect said he did not flee because he had not been healed yet." Sterling considered all this and decided that there were two kidnappers after all. At least two. Rackley had to be in on it with him. A guy as dumb as Blaisdell sure hadn't pulled this thing off alone. He picked up the phone, made a call. A few minutes later, he got a call back that surprised him. George Thomas Rasp Rackley had died the previous year. He had been found knifed in the area of a known crap game on the Portland docks. Shit. Someone else, then. Someone running the big lug the way Rackley no doubt once had. Just about had to be, didn't there? By 7 that night, a statewide all points, what would become known as a bolo a few years later, was out on Clayton Blaisdell Jr. By that time, Jerry Green of Gorham had discovered his Mustang had been stolen. The car was on state police hot sheets 40 minutes or so later. Around that same time, Westbrook PD gave Sterling the number of a woman named Georgia Kingsbury. Ms. Kingsbury had been reading the evening paper when her son looked over her shoulder, pointed to the police sketch, and asked, "Why is that man from the laundromat in the paper? And how come that doesn't show the hole in his head?" Mrs. Kingsbury told Sterling, "I took one look and said, 'Oh my God!'" At 7:40, Sterling and Granger arrived at the Kingsbury home. They showed mother and son a copy of Clayton Blaisdell Jr.'s mugshot. The copy was blurry, but the Kingsbury's identification was still immediate and positive. Sterling guessed that once you saw Blaisdell, you remembered him. That this hulk was the last person Norma Gerard had seen in her lifelong home made Sterling sick with anger. "He smiled at me," the Kingsbury boy said.
"That's nice, son," Sterling said, and ruffled his hair. The boy flinched away.
"Your hand is cold," he said.
In the car, Granger said,
"You think it's odd that the big boss would send a guy like that shopping for the kid? The guy's so easy to remember?"
When Sterling considered, he did think it a little odd. But Blaisdell's shopping spree suggested something else as well. It was optimistic. And so he preferred to concentrate on that. All that baby stuff suggested they meant to keep the kid alive, at least for a while. Granger was still looking at him, waiting for an answer. So Sterling said, "Who knows why these mopes do anything? Come on, let's go." The all-but-positive ID of Blaisdell as one of the kidnappers went out to state and local law enforcement agencies at 8.05 p.m. At 8.20, Sterling received a call from State Trooper Paul Hanscom at the Portland Barracks. Hanscom reported that a 1970 Mustang had been stolen from the same mall where Georgia Kingsbury had seen Blaisdell, and at approximately the same time. He wanted to know if the FBI would like that added to the APB. Sterling said the FBI would like that very much. Now Sterling decided that he knew the answer to Agent Granger's question. It was really simple. The brains of the operation was brighter than Blaisdell. Bright enough to hang back, especially with the added excuse of a baby to take care of. But not that bright. And now it was really just a matter of waiting for the net to tighten. And hoping. But Albert Sterling decided he could do more than just hope. At 10:15 that evening, he went down the hall to the men's and checked the stalls and urinals. The place was empty. That didn't surprise him. This was just a small office, really just a provincial bump on the FBI's ass. Also, it was getting late. He went into one of the stalls, dropped to his knees, and folded his hands just as he had as a child. "God, this is Albert. If that baby is still alive, watch over him, would you? And if I get near the man who murdered Norma Gerard, please let him do something that will give me cause to kill the son of a bitch. Thank you. I pray in the name of your son, Jesus Christ." And because the men's room was still empty, he threw in a Hail Mary for good measure.